if Chavez had not died, I could see Chavez having become a Mugabe type figure. Maduro, he's never really been liked.
That's Northwestern University's Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez talking about the scenario for Venezuela's president as the country prepares for a May 20th election that's widely seen as rigged. Not only is Nicolás Maduro less popular than his predecessor, but it's looking like his regime won't be getting the same kind of support from Latin American neighbors as it did in the past. Landsberg Rodriguez tells ASUA Online's Holly K. Sunderland why, as well as covering the outlook for Venezuela's oil, sanctions, and much more. I'm your host, Karin Zissas, and you're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latino America in Foco.
America Latina in Foco.
Podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
On May 20th, Venezuela is going to hold a presidential election. It's one of six happening in Latin America this year, but it is not quite like the others. So how is this election different from others that are happening in 2018 in Latin America?
So I'd say there's several ways in which the Venezuelan election going on this month is very much a different animal. The first one is that for many of the countries that are having elections right now, this is the most uncertain election in recent memory. We have no idea who the next president of Brazil is going to be. Even in Mexico, where López Obrador is leading in a lot of the polls because of a lot of the patronage networks that have historically kept the traditional parties stronger, the extent to which polls can be seen as predictive is very much in question, and there is a lot of uncertainty surrounding that. The Colombian election, it seems a little bit more certain that Iván Duque may win, but at the same time, it seemed relatively certain that the referendum for peace was going to pass, and the Colombians surprised everyone. So there's a level of uncertainty in a lot of the major elections that are going on elsewhere. There is actually very little uncertainty in the Venezuelan election. Maduro is, barring a third deviation black swan event, Maduro will be declared the winner after this election. Now, the extent to which that's going to be a result of the inherent advantages that the ruling party has alone, or whether there will be something a little bit more Machiavellian in the wings by electoral authorities, that remains an open question. But the government, which has changed the date of this election several times, would not have allowed for that election to take place in May. They would have found a way to move it had there been any uncertainty as to its final result on their part. Because right now there's a high level, the exit options for this government, given a lot of what has happened over the last 15, 16 years, are very limited. And the retirement possibilities should the government go over to the opposition and investigations take place as to where the largest oil windfall in history disappeared to, a lot of the human rights violations that we've seen, there's almost a bunker mentality from the current government, and they are not going to hand over power, and more importantly than power, impunity easily.
Yeah, I mean, like, he literally has to hold on to power, because if he goes outside of Miraflores, there's nowhere. I mean, he can't go anywhere.
I mean, maybe Chavez's tomb or like Los Próceres. I mean, there's air, you know, there's stuff within view of his house where he might be able to go under guard, obviously. But international travel, when he is in uninvited places, as he was to the recent OAS summit, just tourism, I think, is low on his list of priorities. This sort of archetype of the former Latin American strong person with some of their stolen millions escaping into the blue yonder and being left alone afterwards, that no longer exists. And I think that that's something that the current government in Venezuela is watching very closely. Lula is in jail, and he was a lot more popular than any of the Chavistas ever were, including Chavez himself. And his support in Brazil today is much stronger than the remaining support in Venezuela for the current government. The current government survives right now less because of popular support. The current polling has their base at around 18%, which is half of what had been assumed was the floor for that party. What they have is mostly military support and support from a few well-placed, what you call boliburgueses or boligarchs, which are people who have grown very wealthy through their connections with the government. So if you have the rich and the military, you can stay in power. But your ability to actually wield that power is relatively limited. And that's the situation that Maduro finds himself in now. There aren't easy exits. The idea that you would be able to change the system by working through it is going to be a much less tenable argument on May 21st.
Mm-hmm. And we should say we're expecting Maduro to be declared the winner after the May 20th vote. But he does have one challenger, Henry Falcone, who...
He has Bertucci. Bertucci is polling almost as high as Falcone, which is actually very strongly indicative of how low Falcone's chances are. I don't know if you're familiar with Javier Bertucci.
Not as much as I should be, but I know that he is campaigning by offering people soup. Is that right?
Yes. He is a evangelical preacher. The soup issue is a single part of his campaign. Nobody had ever heard of him. And he is right now has 14% support, which is nearly as he's the only person whose support has been growing over the last month and a half. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, in many ways indicative of the suspicion that a lot of traditional opposition has of Falcone. The idea, or at least the conventional wisdom circulating in Caracas right now, is that following the election, there will be a type of grand bargain, that the election itself is something of a farce. You'll have essentially, Maduro and the government declaring a ceding control of a couple of key political sectors, be it the courts or the electoral council, to potentially Falcone's people. More likely, there's another group called Pro Ciudadanos and Timoteo Zambrano's people. There is a group of very loyal opposition that could be sort of brought in to try and convince the rest of the world that there is some semblance of democracy. Oh, you thought that this was a farce election, but right afterwards, even though we won, we are bringing in the opposition. You know, the important factor being that it's not the opposition in conventional terms. It is a select group of previously pro-government people who have now been declared opposition. So you'd have an alliance of one.
And I mean select in that the government has actually imprisoned other opposition members, barred them from running, forced them into exile, intimidated their families. So they've definitely chosen very specific people they want to allow to be even able to challenge Maduro.
Right. And that's actually something that is very important, because given some of the international backlash over the Constituent Assembly elections, where you had pretty clear evidence of fraud, not in the outcome, but in what was announced as the level of participation. If Falcone hypothetically were to say, Maduro just stole this election from me, and have some support within the armed forces or the Constituent Assembly set up ex ante, the world would believe him. The world would give Falcone very strongly the benefit of the doubt. There would be an assumption that, given this government's reputation, that there were some hijinks, electoral hijinks, and potentially downright fraud that would allow for some kind of transition to take place. So you need someone to be that candidate who you know is not going to, take the very big risk and attempt to salvage it. I mean, Maduro, he could win the election. He could do no fraud, and anybody declaring that he had done fraud would be believed at this stage. Mm-hmm. And that would mean more sanctions. That would potentially mean a lot of the oil partners in the joint ventures that have been keeping Venezuela's crumbling oil infrastructure somewhat afloat, would be more likely to pull out. That would mean more international isolation. These are very big issues that the government is dealing with. And even as they've managed to hamstring domestic opposition, international opposition has been growing much louder and much more boisterous. And they are in a very vulnerable position because the neighborhood is about to change. You've had the right win in Chile. The right looks like it's going to win in Colombia, with Lula in jail. The leading candidate of the of Brazil is very far right, Jair Bolsonaro. That means that within the neighborhood, countries which are in many ways, after Venezuelans themselves, the ones who are most affected by Venezuela's implosion, because you have in the northwest of Brazil, you have a humongous refugee crisis of Venezuelans. In Colombia, you have a refugee crisis. You have Venezuelans getting to Chile, which is very difficult to get to because there's a huge desert on one side and the Andes on the other and the ocean on the other, and they're still getting there. Basically, every country but Bolivia and Paraguay have a steady stream of Venezuelan refugees, and that's something that's going to cause a lot of political pain and a lot of political noise for the leaders of those countries. It already is. Nobody's really talking about it because there's other things going on. Most of the countries have elections. Argentina has its current financial crisis. So there's top-tier news that is making this less of a story even in those countries. But when you visit those countries, you definitely see the extent to which the influx of Venezuelans is affecting that. And as with any influx of immigrants, you're very likely to have some kind of backlash from the local population. So this is going to be an issue in 2019, and it's going to be an issue that's not going to endear the Venezuelan government to any of the neighbors, many of whom are going to be ideologically predisposed against them. And that's something that greatly endanger Venezuela's government's ability to stay in power.
So, what would, if there were a way for the international community to coordinate, if elections aren't going to be a way to bring about regime change in Venezuela, what are the ways that the international community can, especially on the topic of sanctions? We know that the U.S. has issued some sanctions. The EU has been moving on those. What would a coordinated sanctions strategy look like?
So the U.S. has implemented two types of sanctions, one general and then you have the targeted ones. The general sanctions, which involve the bond market, basically stopped Venezuela's ability to issue new debts. And that was something that really tied their hands on one side, but on the other side, it was hard for them to issue conventional debt anyway because of how badly managed the economy is and because, you know, the market itself made it very onerous and difficult for Venezuela, which already has an increasing debt load and falling oil production and no hope of economic reform under the current government, to actually get new money that way. So the general sanctions, in my view, if anything, what they did was to some extent validate Maduro's age-old claim that the world is against them and that the shadowy imperialists are working to bring down the People's Revolution, and here's your proof. The targeted sanctions, I think they could have been played a really important role if they had been done more strategically. What's happening now is that every round of sanctions, they just add new names, but those names are generally not, I think, very strategically chosen. Where targeted sanctions could have been important would have been in taking some of the fissures that already exist within Chavismo, because it's not monolithic. It just goes to great lengths to try and appear so. And in basically making it so that the incentives for the sanctioned group are different from the incentives from the unsanctioned group, and cooperation between the two would be more difficult, which would very much undermine the regime. That's not what we've seen. Basically, what they've tried to do with the targeted sanctions is you know, remind Venezuela that they're watching, add a bunch of new names. So as they've grown, if anything, I think it's actually reinforced coordination, because there's a sense within the Venezuelan government that anybody can be sanctioned at any time. So we're all sanctioned now, basically, which means it's not something that disincentivizes a particular type of behavior. It's not something that that creates a schism between the sanctioned and the unsanctioned. Rather, it's just a matter of time whether you're going to be sanctioned or not. So I think that what's happened so far hasn't necessarily done all that much to help things. That said, where you could see a sea change happening is more on the part of the private sector than on the part of governments. And what I mean by that is, if you look at what's happening with ConocoPhillips right now, just this week, in which they've seized one of the Bonaire refineries of PDVSA because of an old arbitration that went against the Venezuelan government through the ICSID, they're in the process of seizing Curaçao, which is a much bigger refinery. That's something that does hurt Venezuela quite a bit, the government quite a bit, because right now their only income source, basically their entire most of the educated population has left. That has meant that the service sector is basically at a standstill. They have no money to subsidize imports. So the retail sector is at a standstill. The one asset that had been relatively stable, which was real estate, at a time when you have the world's highest inflation, is no longer stable. So you basically have, you know, a perfect storm of brain drain, monetary instability, disenchantment with the political system, which is very dangerous. And the one way you can try and slap enough band-aids on that tumor to make yourself appear to be, you know, to make your prognosis appear better is through throwing oil money at it. So you have right now a situation where if Venezuela loses that Curaçao refinery, it's going to have to find other refineries that are able to process Venezuelan crude. Most of those are in the United States. Venezuelan crude is very heavy. It's very sandy. It's very sulfury. And that makes it very, you know, only very special refineries can actually do anything with it. Venezuela has the highest, has the world's largest oil reserves, but the quality of that oil is not as high as in some other places. I mean, my understanding is that in Saudi Arabia, you can shoot an AK into the ground and whatever bottles up, you put it in your Hummer and you go to work. Venezuelan oil doesn't work that way. It needs to be processed at length. It needs to be diluted by adding lighter crudes, which is another place in which Venezuela is vulnerable, because one of the most likely second general sanction that we might see out of the United States would be to limit American companies from selling light crude for blending to PDVSA. And were that to happen, they could probably replace those by looking to West Africa or North Africa, you know, countries like Algeria, which also have that type of oil and which would be willing to sell it. But buying that oil rather than buying off the U.S. spot market creates other complications. One, the U.S. spot market is you can buy oil at any time. And for a country that, like Venezuela, that has very little infrastructure for actually storing blends and has huge logistical problems, the idea of just being able to buy it when you need it and not having to have it around, because that gives you one more thing to worry about, that's something that's very convenient. Also, you have the issue that Venezuelan crude already sells under the national Brent price. So it's already cheaper than most oil. If you're paying more getting it over from Algeria than you were from the US, higher logistical costs and not being able to buy it on spot, then that's something that is going to eat into that profit margin, which is already lower than for very many oil countries. So all of these are things that can have an effect. What I think is going to have the most effect is actually the fact that Venezuela's oil industry is imploding, with or without sanctions. In a sense, the sanctions are the icing on a collapsing, I guess cake still collapsed, but like a flan. That, you know, it's not irrelevant to the overall effect, but it's Venezuela has lost 20% of its production in the last year, roughly. And that production loss looks to be accelerating. Mm-hmm. So whether or not the international community does or says anything is, you know, at the end, I think that the fact that the government's going to become more and more unsustainable is at this part a fait accompli, and it's only a matter of time. Now, that matter of time can be rather extended. I do not expect this government to fall this year, but I would be shocked to see it around in 4 years. Mm-hmm. So that's basically where, I mean, I would be shocked if Maduro finishes his term, or his next term. Mm-hmm. But I would also be shocked if he were to lose this election or fall this year. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that can happen then. Obviously, the government is hoping that oil prices recover, which may happen. But even if oil prices were to shoot up to 120, at this point, I don't know how much of a difference that would make. The government has become too weak, too ineffective in the things that matter to its own sustainability, like oil production. They've scared off a lot of the joint ventures, which were the lifeline that was keeping the industry afloat. And they're so undiversified that there's really no other way that you can try and get the foreign currency necessary to subsidize imports, even to a point where the Venezuelan masses have the most basic level of necessities. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the latest article I saw on the PDVSA conditions compared the refineries to being like Mad Max, where there's no air conditioning, workers are getting robbed, thieves are just kind of running through, taking whatever they can.
The difference is that in Mad Max, people have ready access to gasoline, which is no longer the case in Venezuela. So if you imagine Mad Max, but the cars are all stalled, mm-hmm. I think that that would make for a better analogy.
There we go. Oh, it's getting there. So, okay, so we've talked about elections are likely not to bring about a change of government. Sanctions, oil production could hobble the government. So I also have to ask about, I mean, there are still kind of rumblings that won't quite die down of a military intervention. Obviously, U.S. President Trump sort of threw that out there last year, and he insists that he wants all options on the table. I also heard other Trump officials this month say that Venezuela was threatening the security of the region. A U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, said that. Mm-hmm. Vice President Mike Pence also was at the OAS this month, saying that the U.S. wasn't going to stand idly by, that Venezuela needed to move, especially on the humanitarian issue. What is your take on the likelihood or the chances of a military intervention? And at what point, I mean, is there a point at which that could actually become kind of the appropriate or maybe the just move?
So that's a loaded question, but I'll give it my all. So first off, I think that the type of intervention that would, when we talk about U.S. intervention, the example that's often cited of a successful U.S. intervention, albeit an unpopular one regionally, would be Panama, with the the military capture while in office of former President Noriega. And there are some interesting parallels. The discussion and the criticisms of Venezuela and their government in the U.S. press and among U.S. government officials has shifted over the last 2 years away from more general human rights considerations to narco traffic. Where I could potentially see a level of intervention would be not from the US, but for example, from Colombia or from Brazil, as a response to the refugee crisis. You might have troops crossing the border to try and stem the flow, at which point, because of the sovereignty issues involved, that's something that could escalate. Again, not this year because it's election year, but potentially next year, once the future governments of Colombia and Brazil are in place. I think that that's something that, you know, that's the type of intervention that might be more likely. A military intervention that was homegrown would be probably, it wouldn't necessarily need to count on the support of the opposition in the way an international one or on coherent support from the opposition. But the armed forces in Venezuela, I would argue, are uniquely ill-suited in the region to stage that type of intervention for several reasons. One, the government has been pretty savvy about moving people around. So at least as far as the armed forces, the army is concerned, the brunt of the National Armed Forces is in the army there, as in most places. They get their leadership gets shuffled around from base to base and from region to region, almost on a very hyperkinetic clockwork schedule. And that means that the time that it takes for them to create the type of bonds with junior officers that historically in Latin America have produced these types of interventions and coups is very limited. What we're having in the army right now is lots and lots of defections among both the junior officer corps and the rank and file. They're just, you know, not showing up for work and crossing the border into Colombia and eating chicken for the first time in a month. That's something that's becoming much more frequent. But at the same time, when you're hemorrhaging personnel, is not necessarily the optimal time to try and stage something. The Navy, they're probably one of the parts of the armed forces that have traditionally been most independent, even now. But Caracas, even though on a map it looks coastal, there's a pretty significant mountain range in between the ports and Caracas. So what role the Navy could play is very limited. The National Guard, which is the only part of the armed forces that has really grown in importance and in stature nationally under Maduro, have been very coddled. And at the same time, one thing that Maduro has given them has been legal impunity. The Supreme Court basically allowed Maduro to pass in the outgoing Congress that he still controlled a law saying that if a National Guardsman feels threatened at any time, they can use deadly force as long as they can say that they felt threatened. There's no real investigation as to whether that feeling or, you know, that perception of threat was a rational or, you know, something, you know, or legitimate. So as a result, a lot of the human rights violations that have gone on during the protests, a lot of the incarcerations, those are things that were a new government to take over, the National Guard could be held accountable for. So there's, you know, regardless of how bad things get, there's a lot of fear as to how the National Guard leaders and even the rank and file might fare during the transition, which makes them in many ways the most loyal to Maduro, except perhaps the Air Force, which in some ways is the most interesting. And historically in Latin America, the Air Force is usually key to any sort of armed insurrection against the sitting government. You know, if you look at Chile, for example, or even Chavez was a paratrooper, when he tried to overthrow Carlos Andrés in 92, the Air Force is usually the most important because they can show up at a moment's notice, strafe the palace, give a signal, and that's something that's unlikely to happen in Venezuela because most Venezuelan narco traffic does not occur by sea. As you might imagine, it occurs by air. The Air Force is, of all the armed forces, the one that is most involved in the types of narco traffic for which Venezuela has become justly famous in recent years, to the point that the most feared cartel in Venezuela, which is known as the Cartel de los Soles, the Cartel of the Suns, is named the Cartel of the Suns because high-ranking Air Force officials, the generals in the Air Force, have sun badges on their uniforms. So the Air Force and the National Guard are very strongly incentivized to not participate. The Army is in no condition to participate, and the Navy is small, and it's logistically impossible for them to play a role. So while given a certain point, or if you were to have basically a big external crisis, maybe an earthquake or something that brought everybody into Caracas at once, you might have a chance, or the chances of it being something coordinated in a tenable way at this time, when the Army is hemorrhaging personnel, when the Air Force and the National Guard have no reason to get involved, is very unlikely. So I think that the military in Venezuela will certainly play a role when change does come. But right now, with or without international support, and I think anything that would remove Maduro would be likely to have international support at this stage of the game. In many ways, anybody seeking to change the system could use that as an afterthought. That said, given the conditions both internationally and domestically, I don't view that happening necessarily in the short term. Again, I think that the best chance for that to happen would not come from the Trump administration. It would come from Brazil and Colombia's new governments as they try and come to terms with this ongoing refugee crisis from the badly managed neighbor.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think, especially as right-leaning candidates in both those countries are leading polls, how that could affect their response to Venezuela later in the year.
Agreed. Another parallel that you could see would be some of the Central American countries that had a lot of these, a lot of similar issues to what's happening now prior to the military takeovers and the civil wars. This is an analogy I try not to think too much about, and I think is unlikely because the Venezuelan opposition is not very heavily armed. Mm-hmm. So I don't see civil strife as being necessary. I mean, civil strife, yes. But an actual civil war I see as being a very outside possibility. Mm-hmm. That said, there are also some parallels there. And culturally, I think there's a very important parallel that a lot of people overlook. When people cite Argentina and Chile and Peru and Ecuador as, you know, a good proxy for what the Venezuelan popular breaking point might be that would actually lead people to rise up despite the costs and despite the strength that the government still enjoys in some areas of the military. If you look at the way questionably democratic transitions have taken place in the countries I just mentioned, it's very different. I mean, on the Argentine model, I mean, if you look at, for example, the fall of the junta in Argentina in the 80s, you would not have, I mean, that the pain being felt by the Argentine people was nowhere near what's being felt by the Venezuelan people now. Mm-hmm. While it was very bad, it never approached these levels. Mm-hmm. It can, I think, be a mistake to view Venezuela in this respect as a purely South American country. Hmm. Venezuela culturally is in many ways more like a Caribbean country than a South American country in the mold of Argentina or Chile or Peru. It has much more of an African influence. It has much more of a Caribbean Pirates of the Caribbean influence mm-hmm. than a lot of these other countries had. And as a result of that, if you look at some of the ways in which these governments like Maduro have fallen in the Caribbean, they don't tend to even go through either an organized military transition or a separation of power style transition, as we saw in Honduras. They tend to just collapse in on themselves. And you can see that, you know, in Haiti. You can see that at various times in Dominican Republic. You can see that in Cuba prior to the revolution and potentially afterwards as well, although not yet. You don't have an organized transition. You have the dictator fleeing at, you know, midnight on December 31st in a private plane and trying to find safety somewhere else, and they leave something collapsed and the people argue over the pieces. So whether Venezuela follows a more traditionally South American model or a more traditionally Caribbean model, given that their culture is really at the cusp of both, I think it remains very much an open question and can lead some people to find parallels that may not necessarily apply, which is a long-winded professorial way of answering your original question. I don't think there is a clear precedent to this, not with a country like Venezuela, not with a system as ingrained as Chavismo is. I think that we're very much in uncharted territory, and that's what keeps me up nights, is that Venezuela, it doesn't have, at least since the dawn of the 20th century, much of a tradition of civil war mm-hmm. Or of organized conflict internally. And it's been spared that, which is something that's befallen a lot of the neighbors. It doesn't have much of a tradition of guerrilla violence the way Colombia has. We had some in the 70s, but it didn't last very long. And then what it does have is a propensity towards urban explosions. Yeah. And if you look at what happened in 1989 in Caracas, the so-called Caracaso, mm-hmm. that's something that back then took place in a very different Venezuela, where the level of armament of the population, the organization of criminal gangs in the urban areas, I would argue that the level of professionalism of the National Guard and of a lot of the state services was order of magnitude higher than it is now. Mm-hmm. And that means that it's not going to be that the real fear I have is that when a transition takes place, what brings it on is an explosion that could lead to a level of urban violence and destruction, which would be far more unprecedented than the situation we have now. Mm-hmm. And that I think would make 1989, in which thousands of people were hurt and killed, a historical footnote. It would be a blip. And that's what really unnerves me.
Yeah, well, and I feel like there were, hints at that last year in 2017, where there were protests. Now they were drawn out over several months, but you did have over 100 people who died over a course of several months, hundreds more injured and imprisoned. And so it still feels like a very, the situation is boiling for sure on the street level.
Absolutely. And that's a story that, especially outside of Caracas, given that the Venezuelan authorities have managed to basically decapitate traditional media, and that the international media tends to conglomerate only in Caracas. It's very difficult for people to gauge outside of Twitter and rumor, what's going on in some of the other major urban areas. And Venezuela is a very heavily urbanized country, and a lot of this goes under the radar. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not necessarily without precedent. We don't know what's happening in a lot of urban areas in, say, China, because that information doesn't leave there. But Chinese authorities can be sort of assumed to have more of a lock on the situation than Venezuelans can, because the government is so disorganized. So, what the tipping point would be towards that level of violence, how much more the street can take before it explodes is an open question. What's not an open question is that at a time when the government spent years handing out Kalashnikovs to supporters that then made their way into the underworld, if that explosion were to come, it would not be fought with World War II era rifles and broomsticks the way the last tremendously violent explosion was. It would be fought with Kalashnikovs and grenades, mm-hmm. Which would make for a much more destructive potential outcome.
Mm-hmm. So, if you're looking for a bellwether for the level of tension on the streets right now, you might want to look to Maracaibo more than Caracas, essentially.
Maracaibo, Valencia, Barquisimeto, any large urban area in Venezuela that does not have the Financial Times and Bloomberg on the ground, mm-hmm. Which is basically all of them but Caracas. Maracaibo, if anything, because the oil industry is there and it has more of a foreign presence as a result of that, there are some eyes and ears in Maracaibo, mm-hmm. because they need to be there because of oil. It's everything else. Maracay, where one of the largest military bases is, nobody really knows what's happening in Maracay. And there's very little foreign, there are very few foreign eyes on the ground there to tell you. And again, what you get because of the a chokehold grip the government has on media that actually fact checks, you just end up with a lot of Twitter rumor and WhatsApp messages saying, somebody told me who I really trust that X is going on. And then trying to find out what that means, if anything, is one of the hardest things that Venezuela watchers have to come to terms with, that you have to choose basically between the conspiratorial and somewhat Panglossian announcements of state media, mm-hmm. and then this dark web of uncorroborated Twitter rumor, and there's very little middle ground.
Okay, so lastly, obviously we've been talking about everything that's happening, which is legitimately discouraging. So many conditions are really, truly horrific on the ground. But you also mentioned that there were some areas of light ahead. What is one of those areas of light that you see in the future?
So I would argue that even though Venezuela most likely has further to fall, I think that the recovery will actually be much quicker and more robust than a lot of people expect, because Venezuela, by virtue of what has happened over the last 20 years, has actually diversified without meaning to, in that I think it will that the Venezuela of the future will be less dependent on oil alone and more dependent on the silver lining of this period, which is actually, I would argue, the diaspora. It's difficult to find a country of the size of Venezuela that has so deeply and comprehensively managed to export its middle class to other countries. Whereas countries like Cuba, they would have a crackdown in which a lot of the middle class would leave, and then they would have another crackdown, and they would leave basically with the things they could carry. Mm-hmm. In Venezuela, you had, because of the exchange system, a situation where it was cheaper for a bright up-and-coming Venezuelan would-be entrepreneur to study at Harvard Business School or at Kellogg or at Booth or Stanford than it was to study at YESA, which is the best business school in Caracas. Living at their parents' house, driving their parents' car, it was cheaper to study abroad because you would be able to buy dollars, which you procured at the black market rate, at the official rate for that student coupon. That meant that you have a whole generation of Venezuela's best and brightest who graduated from the best schools with no debt and no promise to return to their country of origin, who are now taking leadership roles in the private, public, and academic sector. And if you look at what happened, for example, going back to this Caribbean analogy I was drawing before, into Dominican Republic was colonized twice, once by Spain and once by Washington Heights, when after Trujillo fell, all of the Dominican diaspora came in, bought everything, felt that they had a much better grasp of how to do things in Dominican than everybody else in the international community did. When we looked at Cuba, when Cuba looked like it was going to change during the Obama administration, the first movers, the first people to invest in Cuba were the sons and daughters of the people who had left with those briefcases. In Venezuela, it hasn't been that long. A lot of us who lived in Venezuela, worked in Venezuela, or maintained contacts in Venezuela have, brother-in-laws and sister-in-laws and often parents in Venezuela are still very highly engaged. Mm-hmm. And I think that given that you have this new population of hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans who have foreign know-how and foreign capital and foreign contacts, if there were to be a change that would make Venezuela more welcoming to investors generally and for these people to come back and re-engage, I think that that's something that could be an asset which would be much more stable than oil, and which could diversify Venezuela despite its best efforts to be a one-trick pony. Having that level of capital, both human and financial, flood in all at once. So for me, that's the silver lining. But Venezuela has to change quite a bit, I think, before it can be harnessed. Now, I wouldn't say that they would necessarily, that a critical mass of this diaspora would necessarily be willing to come back to Venezuela and work there. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at other countries that have had similar processes, they very often don't do that. But what they do is get involved in investing, buying things, setting up, buying a chain of hotels that your family can work in, subsidizing your cousin's grocery store, which has been, unable to do anything, buying up all of the cacao plants in Chuao because suddenly you can export again. Things like that, you would expect the Venezuelan diaspora to be in a very good position to capitalize upon. And one thing that this revolution has done is make Venezuelans very entrepreneurial. All of the uncertainties of living in Venezuela sort of taught you to look for opportunities where you could find them and try and capitalize them off best you could because you didn't know when the next one would arise. It was very difficult to plan for the future. So you had to always be on your feet. So you have a generation which I think is almost uniquely well-suited to make Venezuela thrive. The problem is that right now there's no mechanism, there's no connection through which they can do so. The government doesn't particularly like them, doesn't really care what they say, and they hate the government for the most part, which is why they're abroad, not there. So there's no engagement now. And one of the things the traditional opposition, I think, one of the mistakes it made was I'd say that they're coordinating now much better with the diaspora because most of the opposition leadership has become diaspora. But prior to that, there was almost a sense that when you left, you were abandoning the ship. And those of us who are still here in the good fight working for change, it's going to bring us closer together. And I think that that led them to a certain extent to not fully capitalize on what was really the only thing that the opposition had, the only asset that they could have had that the government didn't have much more of. The government had more money. It had all of the national institutions. What the opposition had was the highly educated, very influential in their own countries, diaspora that they didn't fully engage it with. I think that the next government may do so. And if they do, the rapidity with which Venezuela rebounds, I think, will be much faster than what anybody expects.
Daniel, thank you so much for your time
today.
This has been a great conversation. And we will obviously be watching May 20th, maybe not holding our breath, but I'm sure we'll talk again.
Bring popcorn.
That was Daniel Landsberg-Rodriguez talking with Holly K. Sunderland. I'm Karin Zissis. Thank you for listening. This podcast was produced by Luisa Lemmy, and the music was performed by the C4 Trio at America Society in New York. Find out about upcoming concerts at musicoftheamericas.org. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or SoundCloud.